Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Herman Pretorius. The first issue we're going to be talking about today is crime, as exemplified by a particular crime story. We're also going to be talking about political party funding, and we're going to be talking about people's pay decreasing. Okay, so this was there are a bunch of crime stories in the news at the moment. There has been this shooting outside of a prosecutor's house in the Eastern Cape, which may have been a targeted assassination. This comes just a month after a prosecutor in the same city in the Nelson Mandela Bay was almost killed. There's also an attack on three MPs who were returning from a oversight visit, Ian Cameron. But the story we've decided to focus on today is much less important than those in terms of its stakes, but it also speaks to a lot of the deeper problems in our system. So this story is from the Daily Maverick, and it's about a copper thief with the nickname Kawasaki. This guy's been linked by a local private security firm to a whole bunch of relatively minor crimes, burglaries, theft of copper wire. And finally, after having run-ins with this guy for years and years, since 2017, he's now 23, they've been having run-ins with him since he was a teenager, they finally think they've managed to actually catch him sort of red-handed. But you may think, okay, well, this guy is just like a really good thief, and that's why he's been escaping things, but that's not really what's been going on here. A spokesperson for the private security company that keeps catching this guy in the, you know, connected to various thefts and stolen property and all that sort of thing, says the problem is that many people in the area know him. He works for some of them and he gains access to their properties. Shortly thereafter, some of these properties are targeted by thieves. But when we catch him, sometimes in possession of stolen items, victims don't open cases. Some of them are just happy to have their property back, while copper cables belong to the municipality and they never send someone out to open a case. Within hours, he is released back onto the street, said the private security spokesperson. Now, Herman, this may seem like a relatively minor story, but I think there's so much here to sort of get into. Firstly, you know, the fact that they've had 8 months for this guy of the year is kind of crazy. And that apparently the police know all of his details and yet appear to have not really sort of checked in on him. I mean, you might be able to think that you might be able to get a warrant or something to search this guy's property for stolen items. Be that as it may, the more concerning thing is that we know that copper theft and vandalization of property is a really big problem. And yet the municipality in Nelson Mandela Bay appears to have never bothered to send someone to file charges against this guy. What's your take on these stories?
So I think two of our stories, actually, you know, these three stories are ironically linked quite strongly, because there is a worrying sense of apathy when a municipality doesn't really care about its infrastructure, doesn't care about whether stolen goods are returned. And why that is worrying is it actually passes that cost on to the ratepayer and the resident. So when a municipality doesn't look after its own assets, it passes the cost of doing that onto the ratepayer, which then forces down the ratepayer's income. It might not be a massive amount in small instances, you know, 6 kilogram of or whatever of copper wiring might, you know, it might not be a terribly insanely crippling amount in one go. But all of these little things add up to a ratepayer and resident burden that is quite actually shocking how apathetic the municipality is about its property. Because, you know, there's more where that came from, seems to be the thinking. And if we get to the story a bit later on about, you know, take-home pay and the pressures of costs in South Africa, we might touch on this again, but these aren't victimless crimes. And the second thing is the tragedy of apathy, not just from the municipality's sake or perspective, but from the police. victims choose not to open cases. But as far as I understand, it's been a decade since I did, you know, criminal law and so on. But as far as I understand, the police is free to open criminal investigations against people. It's not the case that you as a citizen have to go and open a case. The police can themselves decide to open a case. Let's take, for example, the crime of murder. Victim, not really in a state of opening criminal proceedings, so it falls to the police. That means the police generally have the capacity to open these investigations. And now this Kawasaki guy has been caught, what, 8 times or whatever. At what point do you think perhaps we, the police, should do something about this? Because what I'm pretty sure happens, because this happens regularly, is private security would detain the guy, police officers would pitch, sort of talk to the guy, or sometimes slap him around. That happens as well. He could spend a night in the cells. But at the end of the day, it's just such a hassle to open criminal proceedings. I mean, it's only copper theft. So, you know, the appetite for the police, either through just sheer complacency or a bad attitude or a limitation of resources, you know, someone's getting shot a street away, perhaps copper theft is relatively not the priority. But there's this really depressing state of affairs where it seems the agency of the police has just collapsed. I think many South Africans, at least in sort of the middle class, see filing a police report or opening a case number mostly an insurance claims related thing. To us, it is absolutely bizarre. Right,
that's probably why a lot of these people aren't even opening cases against this guy to begin with, because they're like, well, what's the point? I don't think this case is going to go anywhere, and I got my stuff back, so why go through all of the nightmare and hassle of something that has no point?
And that apathy is really shocking in the broader scheme of things, because it's not just with copper theft. I've just read a rather brilliant book by a guy called Gerard Labuschagne, who's a psychologist who worked for the police. And, you know, work particularly on serial murders and rapes and criminal profiling. And one of his many complaints about the functioning of the police system currently is that so few investigating detectives or officers attend autopsies, pathological autopsies, to, you know, look for clues about a murder. If we consider murder to be sort of the peak crime of, you know, that's if we were to draw a spectrum of crime, stealing a pencil versus murder, you know, it's quite high up in terms of the priority. And if the police can't even bring themselves to properly, you know, go through the investigation process of attending a pathology investigation at the autopsy that could unveil critical information, it really does become sort of this lingering question mark. Is what is the point of the police at all? We've got 8 captures of this guy by private security. So quite clearly, they are doing something. The police have then conceivably had him a few times. But now, after a decade of criminal activity, after how we don't know how much damage caused and how many Kawasakis there are in the country, now there might be enough to prosecute this guy. It's just so depressing that if we can't even, you know, like the good book says, if you are responsible in the small things, great things shall be entrusted to you. We can't even look to the police to get the small things right. And it's the small things that ultimately build to reveal systemic rot. And I'm afraid that's where we are. And this little minor story, as you say, the stakes aren't massive, but it just reflects such a deep infestation of mediocrity, of blaseness, that the state of law and order in this country wasn't killed by any great criminological feat. It was just, you know, suffocated by one tiny atom of breath leaving this corpse and ultimately just causing this whole thing to become rather forensically dead.
You know, and this is this is, I think, an important point to make, is the police do need some structural reforms of various kinds. I mean, we've argued, for example, that provinces should be able to have more power over the cops, and they definitely need more resources, and there's all sorts of other issues. But when it comes to a problem like this kind of sort of culture of apathy that clearly has sunk in here, you just need political will to put pressure on management to make sure that the right people are appointed to the right positions, to enforce meritocracy, to get things kind of moving again, to lift morale. Because you get to a point in an organization where if nobody thinks there's any point in doing anything, if it's all just hopeless, if no one ever gets ahead from performing well, if they only get ahead from sucking up or being politically connected or seniority or whatever, then in the end, you're just going to kind of, it like spreads like a sort of like a flu through an entire organization. And I think that is very much the pace that the police are. And this is why you need someone, a political leader, to kind of go and do a lot of symbolic things to start off with, but like not these grand raids that our government loves to do, but like sort of firing non-performers, replacing bad station chiefs here and there, doing this and that, just to kind of put some energy back into the organization. And even that relatively small cosmetic change, I think, would actually produce quite a lot of positive results.
And another example that Gerard Labuschagne in the Profiler Diaries notes is that quite often cases, well, not quite often, he came across a few cases where a victim's number would be notated incorrectly, and then the victim can't be reached again. So then the case is sort of closed. The docket is sort of closed. And he mentions that he suspects that sometimes this might even be deliberate, that it is easier because the incentives are how many cases can you close, how many dockets can you, I can't remember the exact terminology, but he says that this is probably the result of this bizarre idea that you have to chase these numbers of getting, we closed a case, closed case. But meanwhile, these cases don't get solved. They don't get investigated. Prosecutions don't materialize from them. So number one is this culture change. But number two, you also have to determine what does a successful police force actually look like, and have targets and definitions that serve policing rather than just become these box-ticking exercises that, BEE and employment equity have become. It's not actually what does it change life on the ground. It's very much are the boxes ticked? If yes, then wonderful. And credit to someone like Leon Schreiber, Minister of Home Affairs, took what I think is probably the most behemothic, bloated government department, and seems to be turning it around through, as you say, symbolic victories, build up morale. And this is something like that Ramon Cabanac has posted on social media about, that his time spent as a government official showed him that many civil servants are actually in it for the right reasons. It's the political will that lacks. And there's a good chance that is the same for the police, that just the investment of political will, the pushing of targets, the redignification of the job of being a public servant could unlock currently dormant potential in the system.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. If some good performers start to get rewarded and are getting praise heaped on them, you're going to see other people who kind of work on in that organization being inspired. And, that's important for putting away the copper thieves, but that's also important for catching the hijackers and investigating the murders and all of those things. So important lessons, I think, from a little story like that. Okay, let's move on to our next story. President Ramaphosa is set to sign a proclamation to double the disclosure threshold and annual donation limit in the Political Funding Act, which currently restricts you to donating only 15 million rand a year to a political party, and you have to disclose any amount publicly, and it's publicly available on the IEC website, if you donate an amount over 100,000 rand. The president's proclamation is going to double the annual amount from 15 million to 30 million, and the disclosure threshold from 100,000 rand to 200,000 rand. So I see, I came across this story because My Vote Counts project was upset about it, and they say this is undermining our democracy. And I take some of their points. I think that this is being pushed because the ANC is having big funding trouble, because probably it has some donors who are some donors who want to give more to the party but are now limited, and other donors who, you know, maybe want to give a bit more under the threshold, but they're scared to because it'd make them look bad, or it might make people ask questions. So I suspect there's probably impure reasons why this threshold is being raised, but that speculation aside, you know, I really think that this is actually not such a huge deal. I think if anything, the 2024 elections prove to us in South Africa is that funding is an important part of a political party success, but it's not even close to the main part. And that I think this, the power of funders and donors in that is a bit overstated in politics. What's your take on that?
100%. I think you can contrast the Patriotic Alliance with Rise Mzansi. You mentioned Change Starts Now, which in the end became Change Starts a bit later. That the Patriotic Alliance didn't blow the lights out in terms of funding donations. They just did the good old hard work of politics, having a message, repeating that message, having it on the ground, finding new ways to make the message interesting. They did many, many of the good stuff that defines a good political campaign. While Rise Mzansi and Change Starts Now were sort of the poster children for well-funded failure. And I have a bias towards free speech. I have a bias towards protecting the mechanisms that allows speech to be free and expression to be free. And I've always been suspicious of this, you know, this the act here, because I, as much as the reasons for these decisions of changing the limits in terms of the Political Funding Act are suspect, I think the act itself was actually quite suspect, and it in a way backfired on the ANC. I heard from some parliamentarians at the time that the ANC was very much convinced that the processes they were putting in place were there to scupper the DA and the IFP, sort of making a political comeback with the resources they need. And actually it since has backfired on the ANC. So to that extent, yeah, nice, well done act. But the problem is that in 2019, the DA spent, I think, more money on its election campaign than it had ever done, and it went backwards. And the Rise Mzansi, massive amounts of money, terrible return on investment in terms of rands per vote share, with Change Starts Now having an infinite number of rands spent on the votes they got, because we can divide by, you know, zero there. And the Patriotic Alliance just did good old hard work campaigning. So I think money is overblown as an issue. It does bother me at a free speech level. And I've never bought into this idea that political funding is really what's wrong with this country. I think if the corruption is in the system, it won't be solved by exactly knowing who funded which political party. The problems are far more fundamental and just far more obvious, in the sense that it isn't who's funding who, it is who is preventing jobs from being created. And there, that you don't need forensic investigators to understand. It's the policies, it's the economy, stupid. So I think the whole thing is a bit of a storm in a teacup, and it's a teacup I don't particularly think is important or attractive.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty much on the same page there. Just sort of two things to add. The first is that the other sort of galling thing about this is you've got parties like MK and the EFF who clearly have pretty significant sources of funding. And yet they declare pitifully few donations, if any, in the Funding Act. And one really has to ask the question, okay, are they declaring everything because the rules are being enforced for some parties but not for others? You know, this is an open question that no one's properly investigated, so we don't actually know if there is other money coming into those parties. But also, I think, you know, part of the discussion about political funding in 1980... right? Like, imagine you're an American politician in 1980. How do you get big public messaging out? You have to pay TV stations, radio stations, to advertise for you. And that means you need a lot of cash and you need to pay in these, like, you know, congested advertising brackets. You need to pay lots of money to get a message across. We don't live in that world anymore. The internet has created, yes, you can pay for advertising on Facebook or whatever, but at the end of the day, the real, you know, virality in these, all these kind of things can be generated entirely sort of organically. You don't need to pay a lot of money to have successful social media, and that can boost your campaign in ways that, you know, big money spending on traditional media doesn't. So yeah, I think there is, some of these concerns, I think, are also in the past, that we are, I think, not as important as they are now.
And the problem with the thinking, as you point out, is that no past law has ever ensured that those who were violating the law previously would now stop doing so. It's a bit like gun control or gun-free zones. It's like you're catering to target, or your explicit target is a bunch of sort of people who don't play by the rules. So your solution is to make another rule that really, guys, you must play by the rules.
This is a really common South African problem. We have too many murders, so we need to bring back the death penalty. Well, no, we need to catch the murderers. Like, getting caught is the problem part. The punishment part, you know, our prisons are awful nightmare hellscapes. You know, if you actually end up in those, you will probably wish that you got the death penalty in some circumstances. It's not that people are not afraid of going to jail. It's that we don't catch people in the first place.
Yeah.
So just as President Donald Trump has said, many such cases. Anyway, last story. Story just coming through now that South African take-home pay has declined by 1.1% in July from the prior month. And this is mostly due to higher cost of living, including rising municipal tariffs. This is according to a BankServe Africa's latest survey. The survey of 3.8 million people indicated that the average nominal monthly take-home pay has declined by nearly 200 rand from 17,339 rand in June to 17,144 in July. I think, Herman, this is, you know, going back to our earlier point, you know, we are seeing a lot of municipalities around the country having to raise rates, and things like misgovernance, corruption, vandalism, crime, all of these are kind of adding to the cost of living. You don't necessarily think of stealing copper wire as a, you know, as a cost of living issue, but when you keep having to jack municipal rates up because all the municipalities are going bust, replacing everything, yes, actually, it is a cost of living issue.
And Elise Krier, the economist that made this, that drafted this statement, said that above inflation increases in tariffs across most municipalities have reflected inefficiencies, lack of maintenance, cross-subsidization, and corruption, which have eroded local government's resources. So inefficiencies, it's just pure old good competence in local government. Lack of maintenance, basic competence. Cross-subsidization, you know, stealing from the rich to give to the poor, which sadly doesn't work, and corruption. So these are all issues related to the fundamental rot. And it is in a way encouraging, but in a way also incredibly depressing, that South Africa's inflationary pressures and cost of living pressures are driven by failures almost exclusively in our control. Yes, we are vulnerable to the global economy. Yes, the Trump tariff war isn't helpful. Yes, you know, global supply chains and appetite, it all plays a role. But if South Africa were to get our own house in order, the immense relief that will materialize from stable supply chains, prudent fiscal management at local and national levels of government, you know, these are things that could be solved within a few months if done properly. And that's why this is so depressing and encouraging, is the causes that drive the cost of living crisis in South Africa are causes that can be tamed by South African political will if the right decisions are made. So I must say, as we prep for the 2027 local government elections, I really do hope the political parties can translate the cost of living into a local government issue, because it is. At the end of the day, when your carcass is picked so dry, when your fiscus is so vulnerable and your economy so brittle, everything becomes a cost of living issue. And it means that a new type of political decision making, a new type of political debate can really define this upcoming local government election campaign.
Yeah, 100%. All right, let's call it to a close there. Thank you very much for watching. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful afternoon.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.